From Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International, it's Meet Your Mind, a user's guide to the science of consciousness, a special series from To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. This hour, Extraordinary Minds.
We don't realize how creative the human mind is and how creative even the autistic mind is. And this convergence of normally unconnected feelings and ideas and memories is the basis for autistic thought and also for genius.
If you want to know my real task in life, it's to reconceptualize dyslexia from being thought of as a deficit or something wrong with the brain to realizing this is an extraordinary and beautiful brain.
Today, why certain brain disorders, from autism to dyslexia, can sometimes lead to remarkable insights, even genius. Also, a glimpse into our cyborg future. Some people think our brains will merge with millions of tiny embedded computers. And the story of one of the most fascinating investigations of consciousness, a psychiatrist's pioneering study of LSD.
It was clear that this was bringing something from the depths of the unconscious, which was there anyway. So the LSD became for me like a tool to explore the psyche.
Daniel Tammet has an extraordinary mind. In his head, he can do mathematical calculations into the millions and recite pi to more than 22,000 digits. He can learn a foreign language in just a few weeks. But Tammet has trouble with some of the most basic human interactions, like looking another person in the eye or laughing at a joke. He is an autistic savant, like the Dustin Hoffman character in the movie Rain Man. But unlike most savants, Tammet has a remarkable ability to describe his own inner experience, which he's done in a memoir called Born on a Blue Day. Anne Strainchamps talked with Tammet about his life and his remarkable gift with numbers.
Will you try to give us a picture of what your world of numbers looks like?
Well, every number to me is beautiful. Every number has its own shape, its own color, its own texture. 37, to give an example, is a lumpy number, lumpy like oatmeal. 89 is soft and flowing like snow. A number like 111 would be very bright and shining. When I look at a very long series of numbers, like pi, for example, a number that starts 3.1415.92, this number that is used in measuring circles and goes on forever. I hold the European record for reciting this number from memory.
Didn't you do it to something like 22,000 places?
Absolutely, over 22,500 decimal places. It took over 5 hours from start to finish.
That's just extraordinary.
And Oxford University brought in mathematicians to check the recitation, and it was absolutely correct from start to finish.
So when you look at pi, or when you recited pi and see it in your mind, what do you see?
Well, for a number of that size, what I'm doing is I'm pulling all of the colors and shapes and textures that I see in the individual numbers together, and the result is a kind of visual landscape, a numberscape. It's beautiful. It's like a second country, a country of the mind. And it's a place that I can go to and feel calm. And in fact, when I was reciting the number pi, it was a public event. People came, and some of them burst into tears. There were journalists there who asked them afterwards, why did you do this? And they said it was like listening to someone reciting sacred scripture. It was such a flowing, meditative experience to listen to these numbers, numbers that are fundamental.
I can understand that seeing somebody whose mind can do something that's so far beyond the abilities of most people's minds would make people cry, make people marvel. Your mind has also been very studied. You've worked with a lot of scientists. Have you and they come to any conclusions about why you have such extraordinary abilities?
Well, I've been studied by scientists in America and in Britain. My ability to articulate my experience, what it's like to be me inside my head, is unusual. For a long time as a child, I didn't speak at all. And one of the reasons I did that was because silence was a beautiful thing for me. It was a kind of silvery texture around my head, like condensation running down a window pane. And when someone made a loud noise, a knock at the door, a car horn blaring in the street below, it would be like a shattering of that experience, a physically painful experience.
So do you use numbers all the time in your daily life as a way to cope with the anxiety and chaos of daily life?
Absolutely. I count quite a lot. I count to myself when I was a child as well. It was very difficult. One of the downsides to having an autistic spectrum disorder is that you find it very difficult to relate to other people, to do things that most people take for granted, like knowing how to read body language, mm-hmm. how to maintain eye contact, when to laugh at a joke. Things like this I've had to teach myself. I was bullied and teased by my classmates who didn't understand why I was so different from them. One of the things that I would do then, because ironically, I didn't understand what the protocol was, so to speak, for when you're being bullied. So I would go back to numbers. That was my reference point always. I would go back to numbers. I would put my fingers in my ears. I would sit on the playground floor and I would count to myself very, very quickly in powers of two. So 2, 4, 8, 16, 32, 64, 128, 256, 512. 10242048406 8192162846 3276865536 1310722462144 5242881048 576209 7152, and I would go on and on and on into the millions, and the numbers would form patterns in my mind, visual colours and patterns, shapes and textures. It would just be a beautiful experience, and I would be pulled back into that country of the mind, that place of landscapes filled with numbers. And the children themselves, how could they know what to react in that sort of situation? So they were kind of perplexed and just walked away. How could they bully someone who didn't know how to be bullied?
On the one hand, it's wonderful that you had that world you could go to. I mean, there are children who are bullied who don't have a world of numbers to go to in their minds. And on the other hand, it sounds so incredibly lonely.
It was extremely lonely. That was, I think, the hardest thing for me growing up. As a young child, loneliness actually wasn't a problem for a while, because I was so insular, so caught up in my own world, that I had no sense of other people. They were really just like wallpaper, the background to my whole world. And then gradually, around the age of 8 or 9, I started to experience an emotion, a real pain inside myself. It was a kind of like a hurting. And it didn't go away, no matter how hard I tried to make it. And I couldn't find a word for it. I didn't know what the word for this emotion was for a long time. And then I realized subsequently it's what people call loneliness. And I would, in my home at night, sit up in bed looking up at the ceiling and thinking what it might be like, trying to imagine what it would be like to have a friend, because I had no idea. And the turning point came once I'd finished school, because at that point I had done very well academically, but I still was lacking something, and it was a sense of who I was, a sense of self. I read somewhere that travelling was what people do sometimes to find themselves, and I wanted to find who I was. So when an advert came along in my local newspaper to take part in a volunteering opportunity in another country, I applied, and I was accepted and taken to Lithuania, which is a small country in Eastern Europe. One of my other gifts, apart from numbers, is languages, and I was able to learn Lithuanian very, very quickly whilst I was there.
Well, how long did it take you to learn Lithuanian?
A matter of weeks.
To complete fluency?
Well, I will give an example. I, at one point, was walking home from work, and a Lithuanian man came up to me and asked directions, in Lithuanian, of course. And I have a very poor sense of direction, and so I just very apologetically and politely explained to him in Lithuanian that I couldn't help him. I didn't know where this particular place was. And instead of understanding this, you know, perhaps from my accent or something, he assumed I was Lithuanian and kept asking me over and over again, until I said to him in Lithuanian, "Atsiprašau, excuse me, bet aš nesu Lietuvis, I'm not Lithuanian. Aš esu iš Anglijos, I'm from England." And his eyes went so wide in his face that he couldn't believe an Englishman was speaking to him in his own language. And he apologized and walked off. But Lithuania was wonderful, because I met people who for the first time looked beyond the things that made me different to them, and saw the things that were the same.
Daniel Tammet, speaking with Anne Strainchamps. Tammet's memoir is called Born on a Blue Day. You're listening to a recording of a piano recital by a man named Leslie Lemke. May not seem especially memorable, except after you learn that Leslie started playing like this the first time he ever sat down at a piano, without ever taking a lesson. He's an autistic savant, what the psychiatrist Daryl Treffert calls an island of genius. Treffert's one of the world's experts on people like Leslie. He's been studying savant syndrome for decades, and he's known Leslie Lemke for more than 30 years.
Leslie was born prematurely. I had to have his eyes surgically removed. He was a very sick little lad, and so they called up May Lemke, who was a nurse governess in the area, and said, can we bring him, essentially for a hospice kind of arrangement? And she said, you can bring him, but he's not going to die. And so she took care of him with a phenomenal amount of love. And so she occasionally would put his hands over hers as she played the piano in a very simple kind of way. And then when he was about 14 years of age, they watched a movie. It was Sincerely Yours, which has Liberace's theme song as the...
The first piano concerto, the Tchaikovsky.
That's correct. Yeah. And so they went to bed. About 2 in the morning, May woke up and heard some music. And there was Leslie playing Tchaikovsky's first piano concerto from beginning to end, having heard it one time, playing it flawlessly. Of course, she was startled and said, this is a miracle.
Tell me again what he does. He can hear anything once and play it. So in the beginning, you think, okay, this is just an extraordinary feat of memory, except, of course, it translates into mechanical skill as well, which is no simple matter.
Right. That in itself was remarkable. But what happened is I followed Leslie. I have a clip of him where a little girl came up and played Mississippi Hot Dog. And Leslie played it back faithfully. But then toward the end of that repetition, you could see he's getting a little restless. And then he launches into what could be called variations on Mississippi Hot Dog. And you get a concerto 3 or 4 minutes long that changes pitch and changes key. So he's improvising. But then as I followed him along a little bit further, he began to even go beyond improvisation to actually creating some songs of his own. Leslie has a measured IQ of 58. But at one concert in Texas, we said to Leslie, instead of playing this after you hear this person, would you please play it with this person, a song he had never heard before. So she starts playing. He waits about 3 seconds. And then he hears what she's playing. He's processing and outputting it at the same time. That's parallel processing. That is not an IQ of 58.
How unusual is Leslie Lemke? I mean, you've done a lot of study of what you call prodigious savants.
Yes.
These are people who, as I understand it, have neurological disorders, but then they have these extraordinary talents as well. Is it unusual?
About 1 out of 10 autistic persons has some savant abilities. It may be memorizing license plates or those kinds of things. Then there's a second level of savants that I call talented savants. These are people whose skill is more honed, it's more conspicuous, and it's usually a single element, either math, music, or art ordinarily. And then there's a third level that I call the prodigious savant. And these are people whose skills are so spectacular, if they were not disabled, we would call them a genius. And that is a very rare condition. My estimate is that there are fewer than 100 known prodigious savants living worldwide at the present time.
I want to talk about one of the other savants you have vast experience with, right. Kim Peek.
Yes.
Who was the role model, I understand, for Dustin Hoffman in Rain Man.
Correct.
Similar in some ways to Leslie Lemke?
Yes. Raymond Babbitt in Rain Man is an autistic savant. And the movie was inspired by Kim Peek, but it's not Kim Peek's story. And Kim Peek is actually not autistic. He also is brain damaged. But Kim is the Mount Everest of memory. There will never be another person with a memory as vast and massive as Kim Peek's. Had memorized literally thousands of books. And he would read these books rapidly because he would read one page with the left eye and the other page with the right eye.
And this is not simply a question of seeing and remembering, but understanding.
Indeed, he would put things together in a way that Google might if you put in a word.
He would find relationships between things.
Yeah, he would. And, for example, somebody said, what do you know about Beethoven's Fifth Symphony? And he said, Churchill.
Churchill?
Churchill. I said, Kim, I don't get it. Beethoven's Fifth, da-da-da-dum, is the Morse code for the letter V. And Churchill always had his letter V. And so he would...
So he was able to access and correlate... huge store of memory. What's fascinating, of course, I mean, he's fascinating.
Right.
But it begins to make you wonder, doesn't it, about what's going on in not just his brain, but ours.
Indeed.
They don't process information in the same way that you and I do.
Right. For example, George Finn, who is a calendar calculator, is able to do these rapid calculations, but if you ask him how much is 5 times 3, he says, I don't know. He's using an unconscious lower-level circuitry. What you see in the savant, damage to the left hemisphere, damage to the higher-level circuitry, and you end up with right brain skill and unconscious ability, which they're not able to describe how they do it.
What does this mean for the rest of us? Because part of this is an exploration into what the brain is doing, and I gather you've suggested we're not going to know our brains until we have a better understanding of their brains, the brains of the savants.
Correct. My suggestion is that we all have a massive amount of memory stored to which we don't have access. Likewise, I think we have talent or ability to which we don't have access as the acquired savant does.
One of the fascinating things it seems to me you're suggesting is that it's not just memory of everything we've experienced during our lives, but there's something more. You've talked about what you call genetic memory, and that's entering a whole different area of discussion, isn't it?
It is. When I was in training and people talked about Carl Jung and his collective unconscious, I said, that's pretty soft stuff.
So why have you changed your mind?
From what I've seen. In savants, they know things they never learned. Leslie Lemke knows the rules of music, but he never learned them. And other math savants know the rules of math, and they never learned them. Well, how is it possible? It seems to me that that's embedded there, probably in all of us. And so while I was skeptical of Jung's collective unconscious, I'm convinced that there is this huge memory bank.
Which brings us to the question that I'm sure by this time everybody wants an answer to. Is there any way for us to access these?
Part of what has come to me working with the savant is that we do have these dormant capacity memory-wise and talent-wise. And how can one access that? Well, Dr. Alan Snyder in Australia uses what he calls the thinking cap, puts to sleep the left anterior temporal area with rapid electrodes, the drawing on the right side of the brain, is one way. You know, we're kind of a left brain society. We depend on the left brain, logical, sequential thinking and language, and they serve us marvelously. But I think sometimes it's just a matter of consciously rummaging around in the right hemisphere and finding out what abilities there might be.
Now, you've been studying this for half a century.
Right.
How often do you visit the right side of your brain?
More and more. I do and try to. Meditation may be another way. Real meditation does take us to another spot in our brain.
It sounds as though there's a spiritual element to this.
I think that's true. One of the questions that I ask myself is there a barrier? The brain can understand the kidney and can understand the heart, but can the brain transcend itself to explain itself? There may be that kind of a barrier.
Daryl Trufford is a clinical professor of psychiatry at the University of Wisconsin Medical School and the author of Islands of Genius. Want to hear more? You'll find my entire uncut interview with Dr. Trafford, along with dozens of other interviews about the science of consciousness, on our website at ttbook.org/meetyourmind. Coming up, living with schizophrenia. For To the Best of Our Knowledge, I'm Jim Fleming. This hour, Extraordinary Minds, is part of our special series, Meet Your Mind, a user's guide to the science of consciousness. Brought to you by Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International.
Our series, Meet Your Mind, A User's Guide to the Science of Consciousness, is supported by Promega Corporation, providing tools and technologies for research in life science, and the Knorr Foundation, exploring meaning and commonality of human experience.
Extraordinary minds, minds that work differently, can just as easily be a burden as a gift. Aubrey Rauf knows this well, an audio engineer and a producer. Aubrey is also bipolar, having a mental illness that has made him acutely aware of how our minds can shape and distort reality, especially for people with schizophrenia.
When you're bipolar, you live with two different versions of reality. There's a version everyone else seems to inhabit, and then there's your own mood-altered version. When my mood changes, sometimes drastically, it's like shifting color filters on a camera. The same scene can look dark and gloomy, or way too bright, or somewhere in between. I've learned to try to ignore the shifting colors of emotion and focus on what's real. But there are other conditions that can mess with reality itself, like schizophrenia, which is a thought disorder. Being mentally ill, I sometimes wonder, what would it be like to be schizophrenic?
The way I describe it is like a waking nightmare, where you have all the bizarre images and possible things happening and the utter terror. But with a nightmare, you sit up and open your eyes and it goes away. Not the case with a psychotic episode.
Ellen Sachs is a professor of law, psychology, and psychiatry at the USC Gould School of Law, and she is also schizophrenic. When most people hear schizophrenia, they don't think professor, they think crazy street person, and that stigma and lack of understanding is one of the big obstacles patients face.
Stigma is really, really powerful. There are very few things that can shut down someone's life as quickly as everybody agreeing they don't have one.
That's Ed Irwin. He's also schizophrenic, and we'll hear more from him later. The word schizophrenia is made of the Greek words for split and mind, but it might be more accurate to think of it as a mind shattered, where the boundary between truth and fantasy can blur or dissolve completely. Schizophrenia has many symptoms, but the most dramatic are what are called positive. They're what the illness gives you, and you don't want them. They fall under the term psychosis. Imagine not being able to tell the difference between even the wildest idea and reality. One of Ellen's frequent delusions is that she used to be God. Joking, her husband once asked if she quit or was fired. Psychosis isn't something that's on or off, though. Ellen explained that it's more like a dimmer.
I'll have a transient psychotic thought. I've killed hundreds of thousands of people with my thoughts, and I'll just step back and I'll say, Ellen, that's just your illness acting up. Pay it no mind. Further along the spectrum, I have what's called social judgment, which is to say, I'm always aware of what other people will think is crazy, and I don't want to appear as crazy, so I just don't say those things. And if I can't help saying them, I go home and stay away from people. And at the far end, I'm crouching in a corner shaking, and that lasts for weeks. That hasn't happened in a decade.
I'm poisoning.
Do not betray us.
Things I touch are poisoned. People I get near.
Probe into your brain.
Probably the most well-known symptoms of schizophrenia are hallucinations, and they can be much more complex than you might imagine. Here's Ed again.
When you get really extreme, the human mind attached to the human body is capable of just about anything.
And anything that can be experienced can be hallucinated, including smells or tastes or worse.
You can have tactile hallucinations. Quite a few people are under the impression they're insects crawling under their skin. Very upsetting.
Ellen told me instead of voices, she has what she calls thought commands, as though the thoughts of strangers are randomly invading her head. Most of us have had a taste of this experience. Maybe you thought you heard someone say your name, or at some point caught a glimpse of someone you couldn't have seen. It may sound strange, but even when we're healthy, our brains create as much reality as they interpret. For most schizophrenics, these symptoms are only severe a fraction of the time, and with practice, can even be ignored. In fact, the positive symptoms aren't what cause the most harm at all. The much more devastating part of the illness are the negative symptoms. These are what schizophrenia takes away from you. Here's University of Wisconsin psychiatrist Ron Diamond.
Negative symptoms are when you lose motivation, you lose spontaneity, you lose creativity, you lose the ability to persist in something whether you want to keep doing it or not. And the loss of being able to motivate and to initiate behavior is often much more disabling than hearing voices or believing things that other people disagree with.
Mental illnesses can weigh you down in so many different ways. There's social pressure to be normal, to pass, but there's also fear about what could happen if you fall short. In rough times, jobs, families, and friends can all fall away, and then there's the possibility of ending up in a mental hospital. Generally, these are not places you want to be. I've avoided that, but many are just one episode away. Schizophrenia is also a lonely illness. Being in the bipolar community, I can hold up a list of heroes who have done amazing things, like Mike Wallace or Ernest Hemingway, but there's no real list like that for schizophrenics. This is in part due to the more debilitating symptoms that can hinder creativity, but also because of the negative public image the illness has. People who are doing well usually don't advertise their schizophrenia and certainly don't make the news.
When you walk up to somebody in the street who's panhandling and looking odd and behaving oddly, you say, "Oh, this person is psychotic. They must have schizophrenia." But when you go into your dentist, unless he or she has a big S on their chest, you don't realize that person also has schizophrenia. And when you go to the bank and the bank teller is behaving absolutely normally, you don't say, "Oh, that person has schizophrenia." So what we get reinforced with is all of the people who are doing most poorly and most symptomatically who are behaving oddly. And what we miss are all the people with this illness who, through sometimes significant struggle, are behaving pretty normally, fulfilling role functions, living their lives as best they can, with an illness that often makes that much more difficult.
So when you think about schizophrenia and other mental illnesses, please don't linger on the few who do make the news for doing terrible things. Think of the millions out there who we pass every day and don't even know it. They're people just like you, trying to live their lives, whose minds just happen to carry a little extra weight.
That was producer Aubrey Ralph. If you'd like to learn more, you can read Ellen Sack's autobiography, The Center Cannot Hold, My Journey Through Madness. Could you imagine intentionally triggering a psychotic state of mind? Believe it or not, some psychiatrists have done this to try to understand mental illnesses, like schizophrenia. And one of their tools, at least some years back, was the powerful hallucinogen LSD. They not only gave the drug to their test subjects, they often took a hit themselves, at least before federal authorities cracked down on this kind of research. Stanislav Grof was one of the early pioneers in the study of LSD. And since then, he's devoted his life to exploring non-ordinary states of consciousness. Grof recently stopped by our studio to talk with Steve Paulson.
You've said that your life changed dramatically one day in 1956, the first time you took LSD. What happened then?
Well, I was working at the psychiatric department of the School of Medicine in Prague. And one day we got a box of ampules. We opened it and it said LSD-25. This supply came from Sandoz, and they say, "Would you work with the substance? We feel that maybe there is some use for it in psychiatry and psychology."
So the idea then was the use would be for therapeutic purposes.
The main focus was experimental psychosis. When he gave it to these people, it seemed that the experiences that they were having were very similar to what you see in naturally occurring psychosis. If this is the case, then what we call mental diseases might not be mental diseases at all. They would be kind of aberrations of body chemistry, and you would have something that would be a holy grail in psychiatry, which means a test tube solution for schizophrenia and other psychosis.
So here you were, a young psychiatrist. The shipment of LSD just arrived at your lab in Prague. You decided to take some?
Well, I became, you know, one of the early volunteers, and that's where I had an experience that within a few hours really changed me personally and send me professionally in a completely new direction.
What happened during that first experience?
Well, my preceptor was very interested in electroencephalography, which means exposing people to a stroboscopic light. So between the third and fourth hour, when my experience with LSD was culminating, which was powerful enough, this research assistant came and said, this was time for the experiment. So she took me into a small room. I lay down. She put the electrodes on my head and then asked me to close my eyes and then put this gigantic strobe, you know, put it above my head and turn this thing on.
So you had a strobe light.
Strobe light on top of the
effect on top of the LSD.
And suddenly there was light like I had never seen in my life. I couldn't even imagine existed. Like when you read about the mystical experiences, like millions of suns. At the time, I thought this is what must have been like in Hiroshima when the bomb went off. Today, I think it was more like what's called Dharmakaya in the Tibetan Book of the Dead, the primary clear light that you see at the moment of your death. But what happened, my consciousness was catapulted out of my body. I lost the research assistant, the clinic, Prague, the planet, and suddenly I had the feeling I became nothing. My old self was extinguished, but I had the feeling I became all of existence. And I understood that what they taught me in the medical school about consciousness is somehow coming out of the complexity of the neurophysiological processes in the brain simply was not true, that consciousness was something much, much larger. It was a kind of a cosmic matrix, or it's kind of teased out of it.
Now, what had been your orientation, your scientific orientation before that experience? Did you have a sort of a more conventional materialistic understanding of science?
Well, I grew up in a family that had no religious affiliation. From this kind of background, I went to medical school at a time when we were controlled by the Soviet Union. So we got the purest materialistic doctrine that you can have.
So you were basically, you were an atheist at that time.
I was an atheist, convinced, you know, I thought I had a scientific worldview. This, the history of the universe is the history of matter. And somehow life, consciousness, intelligence is something that happened as a kind of fluke in an insignificant part of the universe that has, you know, billions of galaxies.
So then you had this quite literally, this mind-blowing experience, which you say changed your life. I mean, changed.
So I'm a somewhat unusual case of somebody who was brought to mysticism, not to religion, but to mysticism, to spirituality, by scientific research, laboratory and clinical research. Usually it's the other way around. People get very intense religious indoctrination. And when they discover materialistic science, they tend to say the whole thing is nonsense, unscientific, you know, primitive, magical thinking. I am a scientist. I am a rational person. And they tend to reject anything related not just to religion but to spirituality.
So what happened then in your career after that? It sounds like you entirely switched tracks.
Well, I joined a group of scientists who were both sort of psychologists, psychiatrists, and biochemists who had access to psychedelics. And for the first 2 years, we pursued the experimental psychosis idea, which means we had a group of about 40 people, including ourselves, who came to the research institute and then get one of psychedelics that we had, LSD, then we had psilocybin, we had mescaline from Germany.
Was all this legal to do at the time?
It was legal, absolutely legal, yeah. We were drawing blood, you know, every hour on the hour. We were collecting samples of urine. We were doing electrophysiological experimentation, you know, very, very scientific. And during this time, something started dawning on me. Each of the experimental persons had a very different kind of experience, unbelievable range of experiences. So I realized this was not an ordinary pharmacon. And then also, if we had the same substance repeatedly, each session was different. And then at a certain point, I realized we are actually working with a catalyst. we are not having LSD experiences or psilocybin experiences. We are having experiences of ourselves.
It would seem that the psychedelic, whether LSD or psilocybin, was triggering something inside your head.
Yeah, well, but it was clear that this was bringing something from the depths of the unconscious, which was there anyway. So I started seeing something like LSD, like a microscope or a telescope, like a tool that makes it possible for you to study phenomena which were real, but were not available without using that. So the LSD became for me like a tool to explore the psyche. I went back to psychoanalysis, but now sort of LSD-assisted or psychedelic-assisted psychoanalysis, and that was the beginning of a whole other area.
How many sessions do you figure you sat in on?
Personally, in probably over 4,000 psychedelic sessions over the years.
Over 4,000?
Yeah.
Has anyone else witnessed so many psychedelic sessions?
Not in the academic circle, but I know that, you know, there are people who are doing it in outside of the official.
Yeah. And to put this into perspective, I mean, this was all before Timothy Leary and Richard Alpert did their famous, infamous studies at Harvard.
You know, Tim Leary had his first session in 65, whereas the session I described was like 56, almost 10 years before. LSD was very respectable.
So what you've described so far is your the early part of your career, starting out as a psychiatrist, using the techniques of psychoanalysis, working in clinical settings, trying to help people sort out some of their personal issues. At some point, maybe from the very beginning, I don't know, you became very interested in what's been called non-ordinary states of consciousness. Obviously, we're talking about some of these now.
Well, that was actually my first session. This was a non-ordinary state. And
right.
So I think the most important part of my work then became mapping the psyche. So I came with this very narrow model of psychoanalysis, which is basically limited to the Freudian individual unconscious. Then you have this whole area of the Jungian archetypal collective unconscious, where we can experience mythology of other cultures that we have never studied in this lifetime. So that's there we really get to the problem of, where does that come from?
And when you start talking about Carl Jung and his notion of the collective unconscious, I mean, which has been a tremendously powerful idea for the last century, I think a lot of people would say, fascinating, but you've left science. Are you still in the scientific realm here when you talk about this kind of thing?
Well, I believe you are in a scientific realm, but science isn't there yet. I mean, the materialistic science is not there. There are certain experiences that the current conceptual framework cannot explain. But that doesn't mean that those experiences don't exist.
Stanislav Grof is one of the founders of transpersonal psychology. His books include When the Impossible Happens and LSD, Doorway to the Numinous. If you'd like to hear more, you'll find Steve's complete uncut interview with Grof on our website at ttbook.org/meetyourmind. Will computers merge with our brains to create a new kind of consciousness? Coming up, Ray Kurzweil on our cyborg future. For To the Best of Our Knowledge, I'm Jim Fleming. This hour, Extraordinary Minds, is part of our special series, Meet Your Mind, A User's Guide to the Science of Consciousness, brought to you by Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International.
Our series, Meet Your Mind, A User's Guide to the Science of Consciousness, is supported by Promega Corporation, providing tools and technologies for research in life science, and the Knorr Foundation, exploring meaning and commonality of human experience.
Marianne Wolfe knows as much as anybody on the planet about what the human brain is actually doing when it reads. She runs the Center for Reading and Language Research at Tufts University and enjoyed significant popular success for her last book, Proust and the Squid, the story and science of the reading brain. But as Anne Strainchamps found out, Wolf is equally passionate about the dyslexic brain.
These are brains that are wired to see spatial patterns, to see the big picture, to go outside the box, to think holistically. Often they're artists, often they're architects. And yeah, that same advantage or set of advantages which made them before literacy our generals, our builders, a lot of our great figures, that made a disadvantage at the same time for some of the wiring that goes into left hemisphere language processes. Now, the real, if you want to know my real task in life, it's to reconceptualize or to help reconceptualize dyslexia from being thought of as a deficit or something wrong with the brain to realizing this is an extraordinary and beautiful brain that we have failed as an educational system to know how to teach easily when it comes to reading. But that is a failure not of the child, but of us to understand. And one of the joys for me in brain imaging is that we're able to look and see how many of our individuals with dyslexia have such interesting right hemispheric processes, and when you look at how they read, are using the right hemisphere inefficiently for a left hemisphere-like task.
You know, what's really interesting is the way you describe it. It sounds as though people who are dyslexic, who are often regarded by teachers as handicapped, actually may be among the most gifted of us. I mean, rather than having any kind of deficit, they may be really gifted.
Well, I want to say two things. The first is that some of the greatest inventors and artists that we know have a history of dyslexia. We look at Picasso. We look at Thomas Edison. We look at Gaudi. We look at Rodin. We look at modern entrepreneurs who are looking outside the box at a global level all the time in the world of finance. Charles Schwab, Paul Orfalea. You look at Silicon Valley. You see in a study by Julie Logan in London, they found that 35% of entrepreneurs, successful entrepreneurs, have had a history of dyslexia. That's a percentage that is not coincidental. And then you look in your classrooms, or you ask for the histories of some of these wonderful individuals, and they will tell you they thought they were stupid. They had teachers who did not know. They weren't trained. They didn't realize any of this. And they felt the children were simply not working to potential or were lazy. Nothing could have been less true, but the child doesn't know that they aren't working to potential. The child thinks they're working and failing. Now, the most resilient are great successes, but many people aren't.
Could neuroscience point the way to discovering new pathways to help dyslexic children learn to read more easily?
This is the question that has motivated the last 15 years of my life, and I believe we're really closing in on it. Our goal is to develop principles that all programs should use to help teach our children who have difficulties. So yes, the answer is an optimistic yes.
Marianne Wolf is the director of the Center for Reading and Language Research at Tufts University. She spoke with Anne Strainchamps. Ray Kurzweil is one of the world's leading inventors and futurists. He's been described as the ultimate thinking machine, and he believes we're all on our way to becoming thinking machines, literally. Kurzweil says we'll soon have tiny computers embedded in our brains. He thinks we're on the verge of a new era in evolution, a fusion of biology and machine technology. Kurzweil spells out this visionary future in his books The Singularity Is Near and How to Create a Mind. He tells Steve Paulson what we can look forward to.
We'll have nanobots, blood cell-sized devices that have powerful computers in them and communication devices. They'll all be on a wireless local area network. They'll be on the internet, and we can have billions of them in our brain. Today we have neural implants. In fact, some of them are programmable from outside the patient, like the FDA-approved Parkinson's implant. But these have to be surgically implanted. We'll be able to send them in without surgery, and not just to one spot in the brain, but to billions of locations, and have them interact with their biological neurons. And really evolve into a hybrid of biological and non-biological intelligence by the late 2020s.
So what does that mean if we are, in a sense, hooked up to the internet just constantly all the time because we have this technology implanted in our brain? What changes at that point?
Well, some people feel we're already there, but we do have to interact with our computers, which for the most part are outside our bodies today, but they're going to make their way inside our clothing and ultimately inside our bodies. Once we can build computers that are the size of blood cells in the early 2020s, they'll be interacting with our bodies and brains to vastly expand human intelligence. Now, one thing that's important to understand is that once the non-biological intelligence gets a foothold in our brains, that non-biological portion of our intelligence will double in power every year, not because it's self-replicating, but just because that's the nature of what I call the law of accelerating returns, and that's been going on for a century and will continue. Our biological intelligence is basically fixed. By my calculations, we have 10 to the 26th power calculations per second among all the human brains in the world, and that'll be the same 50 years from now. But by the 2020s, we'll achieve the crossover point. And in 2030s, the non-biological portion of our intelligence will be much more powerful than the biological portion. And by the 2040s, I put the date for the singularity at 2045, because at that time, the non-biological portion of our intelligence, the intelligence of our civilization, will be a billion times more capable than the biological portion.
Now, when you talk about all of this intelligence, I mean, becoming millions or even billions of times more intelligent than what the biological brain is today, are you basically talking about the computational power of the brain, or are you talking about all kinds of things? I mean, other kinds of neural capacities?
Okay, good question. If we talk about human intelligence, we can identify both hardware, computational ability, and software, which is to say the methods, the principles by which we can recognize patterns or display emotional intelligence or solve analytical problems and so on. In order to achieve human levels of intelligence, so-called strong AI, strong artificial intelligence, we need both the hardware and the software.
So you're talking about computer artificial intelligence that shows love and happiness and all of those very human emotions.
That's right. All that takes place in our brain. Our emotional intelligence is not something sort of stuck on the side as a sideshow. It's actually the cutting edge of human intelligence. Being funny, being jealous, expressing a loving sentiment, these are very complex, sophisticated behaviors. It's actually the most intelligent thing that we do. But we will ultimately understand that.
Well, suppose this future comes to pass, what you've just laid out, and we're in the year 2050, and there are all of these super smart people. How does life change at that point, and what's different?
We will go through a stage in the 2020s and 2030s where we are putting these intelligent nanobots in our bloodstream, which will keep us healthy from inside, augment our immune system, provide dramatic gains in human life expectancy, and then expand our mental functions. We'll still be human-like, but we'll have these mental prostheses. Now, some people might say that search engines are already a memory enhancement. I certainly use them. In fact, I may be on interviews, and I'm sitting there on my search engine and looking up facts in real time. And one woman said that her son's computer may as well be in his brain because he carries it around with him all the time. But over time, and because of this exponential growth, that non-biological portion of our intelligence will ultimately predominate. And we'll have human-level intelligence that doesn't have a physical body in real reality, but we'll be able to project bodies in virtual reality. We'll be spending more and more time in virtual reality. For example, if you want to go in virtual reality, the nanobots shut down the signals coming from your real senses, replace them with the signals that your brain would have been receiving had it been in the virtual environment. And to your brain, it feels like you're in that virtual environment. It can be just as realistic and compelling as real reality. You go to move your arm and your legs, but it moves your virtual body. So for your real body, your virtual body doesn't have to be the same body you have in real reality. Design of new virtual reality environments and new bodies to inhabit those environments will be a new art form. You can go there with one other special person or 100 people from anything from a conference to an intimate encounter and have these virtual experiences involving all of your senses.
Does the physical body become irrelevant? Does it become an anachronism?
Well, we don't abandon old technologies immediately. People didn't throw their manual typewriters away when the first, clumsy word processors appeared, but It's hard to find a mechanical typewriter today. We tend to keep these old technologies around.
So the body, the human body, you're saying, will become an old technology going the way of the typewriter.
Eventually, we'll be able to create human body version 2.0 and 3.0, and you can have different bodies. You know, a couple could become each other to experience a relationship from the other's perspective, or a teacher could assign a student not just to dress up as Ben Franklin, but to be Ben Franklin in a virtual congressional congress. So there's applications for relationships, for education, certainly for entertainment.
Now, of course, a lot of people are appalled by this scenario. And part of what bothers them so much is it seems like you're redefining what it means to be human. And I'm wondering, well, if you see it that way.
My definition of being human is we are the species that goes beyond our limitations. We didn't stay in the ground. We didn't even stay on the planet. We have not stayed with the limitations of our biology. When our genes were evolving, it was in the interest of the species for not that many people to live past child-rearing, which generally meant like age 28, because there were only limited resources, and those were best used by the young and those caring for them. In 1800, human life expectancy was 37. Mozart and Schubert died in the 30s, and that was typical. There was no sanitation, so people got bacterial infections. There were no antibiotics. There were no social safety nets. Human life was very hard. So we've gone, you know, way beyond those limitations already. No other species has a knowledge base that they pass down from generation to generation. They may teach certain genetically prescribed skills to their young, but they don't have a knowledge base that itself evolves. Our knowledge base is doubling every year, and we need our technology to encompass it.
Ray Kurzweil, talking with Steve Paulson. His books include The Singularity is Near and How to Create a Mind. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. This hour, Extraordinary Minds, is part of our special series, Meet Your Mind, a user's guide to the science of consciousness, brought to you by Wisconsin Public Radio. Our series was produced by Steve Paulson, with the help of Anne Strainchamp, Sarah Nix, Doug Gordon, Veronica Rickert, Charles Monroe Kane, and Naya Mukherjee. Our technical director is Kirill Owen. Steve Mullen at Walk West Productions wrote the theme music. Special thanks to two of our sponsors for Meet Your Mind. Promega Corporation, providing tools and technologies for research in life science, and the Neuer Foundation, exploring meaning and commonality of human experience.
PRI, Public Radio International.